at Portland's Darigal plant this weekend.
And students walk out of Portland State University in Portland to support teachers' contract negotiations.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Thursday, February 27th, 2014. I'm Pat Epstein.
And I'm Robert Barncord. An estimated 1,000 Portland State students and teachers rallied at noon today on the park blocks at Portland State University in support of a new contract for the Portland State professors and other faculty. The American Association of University Professors have been negotiating with the administration for 11 months toward a new contract. Today, they were joined by at least 600 students who staged a walkout from their classes in order to support their teachers. KABU reporter Jenka Soderberg was at the rally and spoke with Sammy Alloy, a recent Portland State graduate and legislative and policy director for Oregon Working Families.
So what brings you out here to this rally today?
I'm here because I'm a PSU alumni and I witnessed firsthand the direction of fiscal austerity and privatization that our Oregon education system is moving towards. And we've seen over the last 30 years the consequences of these kinds of neoliberal policies that divest from public services like public high-quality education. It's not good for our economy. It's harming the middle class. It's harming students and workers, and it's holding back our economy. The average student debt for an Oregon student is now $26,000. That means that students are having to postpone decisions like buying a house, buying a home, and it's just an unconscionable burden to burden our students with at the beginning of their working lives. That's why I'm fighting for debt-free higher education.
And what does that debt-free higher education, what's the connection between that and the teachers' potential strike?
Well, faculty working conditions are student learning conditions. And we've seen as a result of the ongoing public divestment from higher education, the result of defunding critical services that are there to support students, replacing full-time, high-quality faculty jobs with increasing amount of part-time adjunct professors that don't receive the same kinds of benefits, don't receive the same kind of pay, and are therefore unable to spend as much time interacting with students and giving them the kind of quality education that they deserve. So the faculty demands are student demands. We want to see funding in a fully funded public high quality education system that students can afford and will create quality jobs in our economy.
What do you think about President Bimby Vell's claim that it's the problem is that the state is not funding higher education at high enough levels and that's why they have to make cutbacks?
Well, I absolutely agree that the state is not funding higher education at an adequate level, but you know, PSU's average administrative salary is over $200,000. President Vivell makes about $450,000 a year and gets his house paid for by the campus. And so when we're saying that there's absolutely no wiggle room that the universities can make to invest in students and student services, and they're outsourcing critical student services like students' ability to access their financial aid, which is our public money, to corporate for-profit predatory firms like Higher One that pass fees on to students, I think that's absolutely unconscionable. And we need to see our administrators prioritizing students and the faculty and staff that are there to serve them.
That was KABU's Jenka Soderberg speaking with Sammy Alloy of Oregon Working Families at this morning's PSU student walkout.
A protest is planned for this coming Sunday in Portland against alleged violations of workers' rights by the Northwest Dairy Association, better known as Darigold. The alleged violations include wage theft, denial of breaks, unsanitary working conditions, and threats of physical violence against workers at a number of Darigold's factory farms in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, California, and Montana. The protest was organized by the United Farm Workers, along with Portland State University students and community members. Our march will begin at 1 p.m. at PSU in downtown Portland and cross the river to the Garigold plant in southeast Portland by around 2:30 in the afternoon. For more about the protest and the complaints against Garigold, KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke with Jorge Valenzuela of the United Farm Workers.
Can you give me a little bit of background on the accusations against Garigold?
We've tried to meet with Garigold since 2011. In 2011, it was workers from a dairy in Pasco, Washington, who were reporting wage theft abuses. They were reporting lack of rest breaks, lunch breaks. They were reporting lack of drinking water. And they wanted to bring these grievances to Garigold in 2011. But Garigold closed the doors on them. Then they had a march. They had actually several marches to the Garigold headquarters. But what's been uncovered since then, we've talked to workers in Idaho and Oregon and Washington State. You know, workers in different companies belonging to the Garigold Corporation were expressing and continue to express, some of the same issues. And the reports continue to come out from different dairies belonging to the cooperatives of issues similar to those at Ruby Ridge. Again, issues of wage theft, issues of no breaks, issues of no lunches, lack of drinking water. What we're doing is we're going to Garigold so that they can sit down and talk to these workers, find a solution to what's affecting them at these factory farms.
Just to clarify, Garigold is it's a cooperative of smaller farms?
Garigold is a cooperative. They own about 550 farms, 550 factory farms throughout the Pacific Northwest. The cooperative is called the National Dairymen's Association, but they market the milk through the Garigold brand.
Most of the reported abuses have taken place at farms and not so much processing facilities, or is it Garigold wide, or is it just a few isolated spots within the cooperative?
The reports that have come out of the factory farms that that belong to that association, the Garigold Association. So Garigold has a very important role in ensuring that these abuses don't continue at the farms. And that's why the farm workers decided to take the issue to Garigold, so that they can do something at the farm level to ensure that the milk that is being processed and sold through the Garigold brand, which is being milked by these workers, is to ensure that Garigold can do what's right for the workers.
Has Garigold responded to these accusations directly at all, or are they just kind of deflecting your attempts to speak with them?
We've gone to Garigold several times to their headquarters. Last time we went, Steve Rowe opened the doors to the farm workers, and we were able to sit down and talk to Steve Rowe for about 45 minutes. But the issues have not been resolved. Farm workers continue to come forward with complaints and these types of reports. So we need more than just a meeting. We need to ensure that Garigold resolves these issues.
When they have complaints about wage theft or no break, are they able to bring that up with the company, or do they have to come to an outside organization like United Farm Workers or Jobs with Justice?
Right. There have been reports. I mean, it's like any company. I mean, the workers tell us that, you know, a lot of these issues, they have attempted to resolve them by speaking to the owners of the farms or the supervisors of the farms. But to give you an example of, something that the workers told us about was at Ruby Ridge, the workers reported they didn't have any drinking water. So what they did is they asked the owner for that drinking water, and the workers and the owner responded that they should drink the water from where the cows drink. And if the cows had not died, then they wouldn't die either. The workers are telling us that they have tried to resolve some of the issues through their supervisors or through the owners of the farms, but, you know, it appears that the violations are recurring, they're continuing. So for that reason, the workers decided to take this issue to Dairy Gold, and they did come to us, the United Farm Workers. Some of the workers have gone to labor and industries in an attempt to resolve the issues going on at these farms.
This upcoming action is taking place on Sunday. Where is it happening?
At Portland State University. The exact address is 800 Southwest Jackson Street in Portland, Oregon. And we're marching to the Dairy Gold plant in Portland, and where we will have a rally right outside of the of their headquarters. Not their headquarters, right outside of the Portland plant. And the address to the plant is 2720 Southeast 6th Avenue.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Jorge Valenzuela of United Farm Workers.
According to an analysis by the Environmental Working Group, or EWG, nearly 500 well-known food brands in the United States are using the chemical azodicarbonamide, or ADA. ADA is a synthetic substance used to make materials light, spongy, and strong. These products include flip-flops that you wear to the beach, yoga mats, and many types of foam packaging and insulation. Vanny Harry, creator of the site foodbabe.com, has campaigned to remove this, quote, yoga mat chemical from the Subway chain's sandwich bread. It is used as a chemical foaming agent. The Food and Drug Administration has approved ADA after a New Jersey pharmaceutical and engineering firm learned that ADA could be used as a, quote, dough conditioner to make bread that would rise higher and form a more desirable crust. David Andrews, Ph.D. with EWG, as their senior scientist and co-author of the analysis, says that American food supplies frequently contain these highly suspect chemicals with little or no oversight or review. An online petition led by Harry has gained over 92,000 signatures and has inspired the Subway chain to commit to phasing out ADA chemical from its bread.
Janet Yellen told Congressional Banking Committee that the Federal Reserve holds no authority over the controversial digital currency Bitcoin. Senator John Manchin has voiced concerns that Bitcoin is potentially, quote, disruptive to our economy and needs regulation. Senator Manchin reminded Yellen that China, Thailand, and South Korea have stated it will not recognize Bitcoin as a legitimate currency, and the European Union is strongly considering regulation. Yellen, in response to the committee's concerns, states the Fed does not have any, quote, intersection between banks and Bitcoin. Yellen suggested Congress ought to take up the subject and ask important questions regarding the legal structure of digital currencies. Yellen concluded, saying that Bitcoin is not easy to regulate because it is decentralized and, quote, because there's no central issuer or network operator. Yellen also told the Banking Committee that the Fed was watching closely the slowdown of the American economy and measuring closely the economic stimulus program known as quantitative easing.
The findings of an investigation into the State Department's selection of a firm to conduct an environmental impact study for the Keystone Pipeline suggests that procedures were satisfactorily followed. However, the organization Friends of the Earth contends that there is a lack of documentation to support those findings, and a member of the organization spoke with KABU reporter Robin Ryan about this report.
I'm talking with Ross Hammond. He is a senior campaigner with Friends of the Earth, and you guys have quite the response for the Inspector General report from the State Department about the Keystone Pipeline and whether or not the contractor hired to do the environmental impact study had any conflict of interests. That about sum it up?
Well, it's pretty clear that the contractor hired to do the environmental impact statement has massive conflicts of interest, but what the State Department found was that it didn't violate its own very flawed and weak rules. Much of the mainstream press coverage had said, oh, yes, there's no conflict of interest, but what the report really says is that the State Department followed its own very weak rules, and even that seems highly questionable. One of the things that is buried in the report, which somehow most news outlets managed to miss, was that the company Environmental Resources Management, or ERM, only disclosed their ties to TransCanada after they had won the contract.
Wasn't the objective of the report strictly to identify whether a procedure for determining a conflict of interest was adequately adhered to?
Yes, that was the purpose of the inquiry. One of the other things that was very interesting, all of the assertions that the State Department has been making that they actually did try to verify ERM's claims, they all come from State Department lawyers who, the report points out, never documented any of the steps that they took to verify. So essentially, the report is based on verbal assertions by self-interested State Department lawyers that they actually did due diligence. And again, this just doesn't really pass the smell test. If they're lawyers, they're aware of documenting things, keeping records of conversations, and supposedly there is none of that, which, again, just makes me very suspicious about what's actually going on at the State Department and why John Kerry, who fashions himself as a climate champion, is not doing anything to get his own department in line.
But there is an additional governmental entity conducting an investigation into this project. Is that correct?
Well, we have heard reports that the GAO, which is basically Congress's research arm, will be looking at the way the State Department has gone about conducting the environmental review. The problem with that, is that those studies generally take somewhere between 12 and 18 months. So it's hard to see that impacting the decision on Keystone.
The reason that I ask is because I'm wondering if the investigation that's going to be conducted by the GAO has the capacity to keep Keystone Pipeline from going any further until such time as that work is done.
No, unfortunately, the GAO is a congressional action. It really has no formal bearing at all on the decision on Keystone. However, there is something else which happened in the past week. There's a big court case in Nebraska which found that the governor and the legislature had violated the state constitution in trying to short-circuit the State Public Utilities Commission. And so as it stands right now, despite all of the oil industries boasting about how they're one step away from approval, they don't actually have an approved route in Nebraska. Almost a third of the pipeline route goes through Nebraska. And as of now, as of last week from this court decision, there is no approved route. So people are questioning how the president could even make a decision on a project where there isn't even a defined route for it yet.
Can you talk about what mechanisms are left to those parts of the public who see this pipeline as a threat to the environmental health of their communities and where they can get more information about how to take action?
Absolutely. In terms of what people can do, there's a public comment period, and people can go to the Friends of the Earth website, foe.org, and send a letter to President Obama and Secretary Kerry asking them to say no to the pipeline. The other side is a lot of money, but we have a lot of people and we have a lot of heart. And ultimately, that's what's going to win out.
I've been talking with Ross Hammond of Friends of the Earth. For more information, you can visit their website at foe.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after our regular newscast for feature story news, followed by Wisdom of the Elders at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is partly cloudy, with a high of 57 and a low of 37 and a 0% chance of rain.
It's 24 minutes after 5, and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The giants of food manufacturing are very concerned about you. They fear you could come down with a terrible plague called consumer confusion. and these selfless corporate entities are going all out to save you from it. The altruistic corporations say that this plague emanates from the grimy and untrustworthy grassroots. Indeed, several states intend to require food manufacturers that put genetically modified organisms in their products to include that information on their labels. Labeling advocates note that since millions of consumers don't want their families eating foods with altered DNA, putting the phrase, "contains GMO ingredients," on the packages will let every shopper decide whether to buy that product or not. It seems both simple and honest. No way, shout lobbyists for the food adulterators. One, they claim that such efforts would create a patchwork of state labeling laws, inflicting confusion on consumers. Also, they say the labels might further spread confusion by implying that the genetically tampered ingredients are, well, tampered with by corporate engineers. So, the benevolent corporations are lobbying Congress to save you from confusion by autocratically preempting the state's authority to write consumer protection laws. Instead, the industry demands that a federal agency be directed to create a national labeling program that would take precedence over all state laws. Not that the national GMO label would be mandatory. No, no, it would be voluntary, so each corporation could decide for itself whether to tell consumers what's in their food. This is Jim Hightower saying, I was born at night, but it wasn't last night. No consumer is so confused as to believe that even a single GMO user would, quote, volunteer to be honest with us. Anything less than mandatory GMO labeling is nothing but flagrant consumer fraud. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Joint operations by Mexican and U.S. drug enforcement officers have resulted in the arrest of drug kingpin Joaquin Guzman, Mexico's most wanted man, in a resort hotel in Mazatlan. Joaquin Guzman was allegedly the head of a drug smuggling empire that shipped drugs throughout the Americas and across both the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans to Europe and Asia. Because of the international reach of Guzman's drug trafficking, the U.S. government considered him a national security threat and had offered $5 million for information leading to his arrest. The arrest is a welcome follow-up to the 2013 arrest of the head of the ultra-violent Zetas drug cartel, Miguel Angel Trevino, and the early 2014 arrest of Robin Oseguera Gonzalez, the alleged second-in-command of the powerful Jalisco New Generation cartel. All three men are considered major contributors to the widespread violence that has plagued Mexican communities for the past decade.
The British surveillance organization, Government Communications Headquarters, known as GCHQ, has secretly intercepted and collected webcam images from millions of innocent and unsuspecting British and American citizens who use Yahoo's online video chat service. The most recent release of classified documents by former NSA security contractor Edward Snowden revealed that, along with the NSA, the British surveillance organization implemented an operation codenamed Optic Nerve between the years 2008 and 2010. The operation utilized a dragnet style of data collection that indiscriminately gathered images of webcam users regardless of whether they were suspected intelligence targets. The documents indicate that anywhere between 3 and 11% of the images stored contain sexually explicit material, renewing public concern over the scope of government surveillance by entities such as the NSA or the GCHQ. Yahoo, the company that provides the online webcam service, harshly condemned the operation, stating that they had no knowledge of the data collection, and Yahoo called on the world's governments to reform surveillance laws to uphold the privacy of their citizens.
The political fate of Ukraine remains unclear as pro-Western ministers take up interim positions formerly held by pro-Russian officials appointed by ousted President Viktor Yanukovych. The country has somewhat stabilized in the wake of new parliamentary appointments, although the nation's culturally pro-Russian regions in the east and south remain disgruntled over the country's new direction. the autonomous region of Crimea has seen the influential rise of separatist factions favoring independence from the new Ukrainian government and closer ties with Russia. Outside of Crimea, however, eastern Ukraine governors have largely expressed their commitment to a unified Ukraine.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Thursday, February 27, 2014. Israeli troops kill a Palestinian civilian in the West Bank and unknown gunmen target a church in Gaza. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Mu'taz Washaha, 24, was killed on Thursday morning after Israeli troops invaded the town of Bir Zeit near the central West Bank city of Ramallah and surrounded his home. Witnesses told local media that Israeli forces and army bulldozer invaded the town on Thursday at dawn and surrounded the home of Washaha. Troops then demolished the house and fired live rounds into the home, killing Washaha. Later, soldiers clashed with residents that gathered around the attack area and fired tear gas at them. Many civilians were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation, and two young men, one is the cousin of Washaha, were taken by troops to unknown location. With Washaha's killing, the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli soldiers since the start of the Palestinian-Israeli peace talks in August 2013 has reached 43. Last month, Israeli troops killed a Palestinian young man as he was working on road repairs near Ramallah city. Elsewhere, three Palestinians were injured by Israeli forces' gunfire on Thursday when they attacked a protest near Hebron against the killing of Mu'taz Washaha. In other news, Israeli bulldozers began to destroy on Thursday Palestinian-owned lands in Jalbu' village near the northern West Bank city of Nablus in order to expand settlements in the region. Local sources said that Israeli settlers started to bulldoze tens of dunams of land in the vicinity of Shavua Rachel settlement established on the lands of the village and the neighboring villages in order to expand settlement construction. In Gaza, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, PCHR, has reported that unknown gunmen detonated an explosive device in the yard of a local Christian church in Gaza City and wrote racist anti-Christian graffiti. The center said that approximately at 12:30 after midnight, a loud explosion was heard in the yard of the Latin Church and the Latin Patriarchate School located in the Zaytun neighborhood east of Gaza City. The Palestinian police arrived at the scene and initiated an investigation into the attack. The PCHR denounced the attack and demanded the Palestinian police and security agencies in Gaza to conduct a serious investigation into the crime in order to locate and prosecute the criminals. The center added that this attack targets the unity of the Palestinian people.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, U.S. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel has directed the U.S. military to begin contingency planning for a scenario in which the U.S. withdraws all forces from Afghanistan at the end of 2014. Currently, the U.S. and NATO and many Afghan elders and officials want to keep a small non-combat force behind in Afghanistan to facilitate the transfer of combat responsibilities to the Afghan armed forces. However, Afghan President Hamid Karzai has so far declined to sign an agreement that would set up a legal framework allowing foreign troops to remain. Meanwhile, the Afghan presidential race is in full swing ahead of the April 5th elections. Karzai is ineligible to run due to term limits, and each of the current candidates has indicated willingness to sign the long-term security deal. However, the U.S. has been wary of supporting any candidate in particular, in part because of accusations of U.S. meddling in the 2009 elections. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ethan Martin, Robin Ryan, Theo Burke, Jeremy Kaplan, and the producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Matthew Olison. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news, or look for us on Twitter at KB News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH, Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR, Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Pat Epstein.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Coming up tomorrow morning, Friday, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Ani and Lynn will discuss recent attempts to legislate the ability to discriminate against LGBTQ people. 5 states are considering legislation similar to that in Arizona. What do you think about the state allowing discrimination against an entire class of people? At 9, on One Land, Many Voices, host Ned Roche speaks with Omar Barghouti, founding member of the Palestinian Campaign for Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, and also Chandan Reddy, professor at the University of Washington, about how the use of boycott, divestment, and sanctions is changing the Palestinian struggle for justice. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on the Radio Zine, members of the GI Coffee House Tour talk about what they do. They talk about the history of the GI Coffee House movement and the current state of the military and just what it means for service members and their families. And at 11:30, Michelle Schroeder Fletcher speaks with Sean DiCarlo of the Oregon Food Bank and David Bolton of the state of Oregon about hunger in Oregon and about the DEQ Food Stock, a variety music show this Saturday to raise funds for the Oregon Food Bank. Big thank you to all of you KBOO members for your support in our recent winter membership drive. And now, stay tuned for a live interview conducted by KBOO reporters and FSN News. Good night, Pat.
Good night, Robert.
Good night, Matthew. Night.
From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's program, unrest in South Ukraine as pro-Russian armed men take over Crimea government buildings, as the US warns Moscow against military action.
One official said that Moscow didn't really see any reason to cancel or postpone the war games. The timing of it created a lot of stir and made many people believe that Russia is flexing its muscles as it prepares to go into war with its former Soviet neighbor.
Also today, we look at LGBT rights in the US as Arizona's governor vetoes an anti-gay bill, and we speak to the director of 12 Years a Slave about why he wanted his film screened at the United Nations.
I wanted this particular part of history to sort of be seen and be heard and to be spoken about, and that people would never forget it.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The White House is calling for an orderly return to stability in Ukraine and has repeated a warning to Russia not to take military action in the region. Ousted President Viktor Yanukovych is now thought to be sheltering in Russia. A White House spokesman said he left power of his own free will. Jay Carney was speaking to reporters after Mr. Yanukovych issued a statement claiming still to be the lawful president of Ukraine.
The facts on the ground demonstrate that Mr. Yanukovych created a void by, shortly after signing an agreement, in an orderly fashion, packing up his stuff and disappearing. And it's hard to claim you're leading a country when you abdicate your responsibilities and disappear.
This comes as Ukraine's interim president, Alexander Chernov, warned Russia against military aggression in the autonomous Russian-majority Crimea region. British Prime Minister David Cameron, speaking alongside Germany's leader Angela Merkel in London, says Moscow must abide by its promises on Ukraine.
We both support a united and democratic Ukraine, and we support the aspirations of the Ukrainian people to live in a truly democratic society, under the rule of law, free from corruption and intimidation. We are particularly concerned by the situation in Crimea. Every country should respect the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine. The world will be watching.
Crimea is planning to hold a referendum on greater self-rule in May. The vote may challenge the authority of the government in Ukraine's capital, Kiev. Meanwhile, a team from the International Monetary Fund will head to Kiev next week. The IMF team will determine what level of international financial assistance the country needs. On Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry pledged a $1 billion loan guarantee to Ukraine. An accused Cuban spy jailed by the U.S. for the past 15 years has been released from prison and is on his way home to Havana. Fernando Gonzalez is the second of the so-called Cuban Five to be released by U.S. authorities. Our Washington correspondent Simon Marks reports.
Fernando Gonzalez left an Arizona prison at dawn after completing his 15-year sentence for failing to register as a foreign agent and possessing forged documents. He and the other members of the Cuban Five are considered heroes in Havana, where a huge welcome awaits him. U.S. prosecutors accused the Five of being a dangerous undercover spy cell. Havana says they were acting to prevent terror strikes on Cuba. Fernando Gonzalez is the second member of the group freed and is expected to campaign actively for the release of the other three.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. U.S. gay rights campaigners are celebrating a decision by the governor of the U.S. state of Arizona to veto a divisive bill that would allow businesses to refuse service to gay and lesbian customers on religious grounds. The move follows a ruling in deeply conservative Texas, which declared a same-sex marriage ban unconstitutional, marking a series of victories for U.S. gay rights activists. Nina Maria Potts reports.
Arizona's Republican Governor Jan Brewer had little choice but to kill the controversial anti-gay bill and came under significant pressure from U.S. businesses and gay rights activists. But conservatives are disappointed. President of the Family Research Council, Tony Perkins.
It's now going to be incumbent upon Governor Brewer to say how she's going to protect the religious freedom of thousands of Arizonians who are saying, hey, what am I going to do now?
The move is widely seen as an effort to rescue Arizona's national image, tarnished by anti-immigration rhetoric and gun violence. The veto follows a string of victories over same-sex marriage bans in Texas, Utah, Oklahoma, and Virginia.
And the first major Scottish business has warned it may move south to London if Scotland votes for independence later this year. Insurance, pensions, and savings company Standard Life says it is drawing up contingency plans to move operations from its Edinburgh headquarters. Our UK correspondent Ollie Barrett reports.
Standard Life insists in its annual report it's not taking a stance on Scottish independence, but says contingency plans are necessary to protect customers and shareholders. And among the material issues Standard Life says it's considering are uncertainty over an independent Scotland's currency, membership of the EU, and approach to taxation. Standard Life has around $400 billion of assets under management, so its announcement is a blow to those campaigning for independence. Scotland votes to stay in or leave the UK in September.
And that's the latest Feature Story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Armed men have taken control of and raised the Russian flag over several government buildings in the capital of Ukraine's Republic of Crimea, as the international community warns against escalating unrest. Rival protests in the country's southern region between pro-Western and pro-Russia supporters follows the formation of an interim government in the capital, Kiev. Moscow has warned foreign powers of interfering in the political unrest, as Vladimir Putin ordered a second day of Russian military combat drills near the Ukrainian border. Speaking earlier, White House spokesman Jay Carney repeated that Russia should resist military action.
We are closely watching Russia's military exercises along the Ukrainian border. We expect Russia to be transparent about these activities and to avoid provocative actions.
Meanwhile, theories continue to circulate over the location of ousted Ukrainian leader Viktor Yanukovych, with reports he's been spotted in a Moscow hotel and that he's preparing to deliver a press conference on Russian soil Friday. I discuss the rumours over his whereabouts with our Moscow correspondent, Anya Ardaeva.
From the very first protest in Ukraine last November, Russia took a very strong stance against what it calls extremists and radicals in Ukraine, saying that it views the latest political events there as a coup aimed at overthrowing the country's elected government. It also maintained that it considers Viktor Yanukovych a legitimate president of Ukraine, and it looks like Moscow is now willing to harbor the ousted president. Some reports I heard earlier suggested that Viktor Yanukovych may be hiding in a residence outside the Russian capital. Then it was reported that he may be at Moscow's Ukraine hotel, but no one has actually seen him there. And the latest is that an unnamed source quoted by the Russian news agencies said that Viktor Yanukovych is planning to give a press conference tomorrow in the city of Rostov-on-Don, which is over 600 miles south of Moscow, a surprise development. He also reportedly published a statement in which he said he remains the country's only legitimate president.
As Kiev announced an interim government in the Ukrainian capital, unrest continues in the country's southern region, Crimea. What can you tell us about events there?
Crimea has seen protesters on the streets for several days now, and this region is the only region of Ukraine where the majority of the population is Russian-speaking. There were reports of dozens of heavily armed gunmen seizing control of local government buildings in the town of Simferopol, and on one occasion an estimated 2,000 ethnic Tatars gathered outside the local parliament to show their support for Kiev and the new government there. They clashed with pro-Russian separatists who said that the new government were bandits. And it does feel like Crimea's population is divided. On one side, there are the Tatars, who account for about 12% of the local population and who want to remain part of Ukraine, and the Russians, who account for 58% of the local population, and many of whom denounce the recent political changes in Ukraine.
Fighter jets have been put on combat alert by Russia along its border with Ukraine as Vladimir Putin continues to test Russia's combat, what they call Russia's combat readiness. What message is Moscow sending with this timely military demonstration, and how's that being received by the US and the West?
Russian officials said that the military exercise in central and western Russia has been planned in advance and doesn't really have much to do with Ukraine. One official said that Moscow didn't really see any reason to cancel or postpone the war games because of the events in Ukraine, but certainly the timing of it created a lot of stir and made many people believe that Russia is flexing its muscles as it prepares to go into war with its former Soviet neighbor.
Ukraine is in serious financial dire straits at the moment. The IMF, the International Monetary Fund, has said today that it's ready to help. How bad is the economic situation in Ukraine, and what offers of financial support have so far come through?
It is quite clear at this point that Ukraine's economy has reached new lows in the past few months, and this perhaps was one of the main reasons for the uprising there, which resulted, as we know, in ousting of the country's government. Earlier, Russia has promised Ukraine $15 billion in financial aid, and even paid Ukraine the first $3 billion in December. The second installment was postponed, and the first one, according to the country's new government, is nowhere to be found now. Ukraine's acting Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk said the country's treasury was empty, and that he expects an economic stabilization package from the West soon to avoid a default. Ukraine is now in a massive debt, and that stands at 40.5% of the country's gross domestic product.
Anya Ardaeva in Moscow. The Ukrainian revolution was also topping the agenda during 2 days of talks at the NATO headquarters in Brussels, where the future of Western security forces in Afghanistan was also a priority. Russia's ongoing military exercises on the border with Ukraine forced reactions from NATO officials and sent waves of concern through Western allied states. From Brussels, Jack Parrock reports.
It was set to be a routine meeting of defence ministers at NATO headquarters in Brussels. But as instability worsened in Ukraine, the Western military alliance was forced to react to escalating border tensions with Russia. NATO Secretary General Anders Rasmussen warned Moscow not to take any steps to aggravate the crisis.
We have no information indicating that Russia has any plans to intervene militarily. We need steps that can cool down the whole situation, and that's a responsibility for all parties involved.
The reaction follows a takeover of a parliament in Ukraine's southern and predominantly Russian region of Crimea and a recent Russian military exercise along the Ukrainian border, which NATO admits has not made things easy, and it's rung alarm bells in Washington as well. Despite being concerned about what Russia's doing, officials at the NATO meetings were reticent to accuse Moscow of any wrongdoing. Instead, they urged all parties involved to hold back from action which could cause a flare-up. The US Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, says American and Russian counterparts will be in touch over the next couple of days to discuss the situation.
We're following this very closely, obviously. We all are. The United States surely is. Until we know more details and what's really happened there, who's in charge, I think the focus should be on let's keep the tensions down. Let's see no provocative actions by anyone, any military. These are difficult times. We all understand that. But this is a time for very cool, wise leadership.
Also on the agenda was Afghanistan. US President Barack Obama announced he would pull all troops out of the country by the end of the year if Afghan President Hamid Karzai continues to refuse to sign a bilateral security agreement. That sentiment was echoed here by NATO Secretary General Rasmussen.
Without the necessary legal framework, there simply cannot be a deployment after 2014. No security agreement, no troops and trainers. We agreed the need to plan for all possible outcomes, including the possibility that we may not be able to deploy to Afghanistan after 2014 due to the persistent delays we have seen.
The Afghan security issue, while important in the long term, was slightly overshadowed by the more pressing events currently happening in Ukraine. NATO's influence in the Ukrainian situation may be limited, but it hopes that Russia and Western allies will keep out militarily and allow Ukraine to forge its own future. Jack Parrock, Brussels.
This is FSN Reports. Faced with outcry from corporations and civil rights groups, Arizona's Governor Jan Brewer has vetoed the bill opponents called Turn the Gaze Away, legislation that would have allowed private, for-profit businesses in the state to refuse service to someone if they claim a sincere religious belief. Our correspondent Alice Olstein explains what brought down the Arizona bill and where similar efforts are still moving forward across the U.S.
When a so-called religious freedom bill in Arizona got consigned to the dustbin of history with a stroke of the governor's veto pen, the conservative group Center for American Policy called it a sad day for Arizonans. They claimed the legislation was necessary to protect individuals from being forced to speak or act contrary to their conscience by serving gay, lesbian, and transgender customers. But when Republican Arizona Governor Jan Brewer explained her veto to reporters Wednesday, she said the bill had the potential to divide the state in ways we cannot even imagine and no one would ever want.
Senate Bill 1062 does not address a specific or present concern related to religious liberty in Arizona. I have not heard of one example in Arizona where a business owner's religious liberty has been violated. The bill is broadly worded and could result in unintended and negative consequences. To the supporters of this legislation, I want you to know that I understand that long-held norms about marriage and family are being challenged as never before. Our society is undergoing many dramatic changes. However, I sincerely believe that Senate Bill 1062 has the potential to create more problems than it purports to solve.
Though Brewer went on to say that non-discrimination is a core Arizona value, some civil rights activists questioned her motives, noting that she signed into law an infamous immigration bill that allowed racial profiling of the state's Latino residents. Much of that law was later ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. Brewer's move in this case came after a chorus of voices across the political spectrum urged her to veto the bill, among them Arizona's Republican senator and former presidential candidate, John McCain.
But I know that the entire business community is galvanized in a way that I've never seen it against this legislation. Their major concern, frankly, is tourism and location of businesses in Arizona.
Several major corporations who do business in the state, such as American Airlines and Apple, had criticized the bill, and a campaign began organizing online to ban Arizona from hosting the next Super Bowl. Eunice Rowe, the American Civil Liberties Union, said this push wasn't only about profit.
Many of the companies that spoke out they said publicly, it is not just about bottom line issues, but the fact that they employ LGBT people and that they stand against discrimination. And so we thought that brought a very clear message on both those fronts.
In just the past few weeks, state legislatures in Idaho, South Dakota, Tennessee, and Kansas took up but ultimately rejected similar bills. But versions are still pending in Georgia, Mississippi, Oklahoma, and Missouri. Their backers compare them to existing legal protections that allow churches to refuse to marry same-sex couples or even couples who practice different religions, and say employees of private for-profit businesses should enjoy those same rights. Rose Sachs, the senior staff attorney with the ACLU's LGBT project, had a different comparison.
You know, 50 years ago, businesses were allowed to turn people away because of the color of their skin, and we as a nation decided that was unacceptable. And fundamentally, treating people differently simply because of who they are is discrimination. And that's just, there's no way, you know, we think it's inappropriate to allow just a little bit of discrimination here, just as it would have been in any other context. Many of us interact with people in our day-to-day lives that we don't see eye to eye with, but we do our jobs, and it's the same thing. Once you are a business that offers that kind of service, you don't get to pick and choose who you serve.
Other civil rights organizations, including the Lambda Legal Foundation, pointed out that the bill's impact would have stretched beyond denying service to certain customers. Because of the vague wording of the measure, businesses could have cited religious beliefs in order to skirt regulations on food safety, building codes, and mediation of workplace disputes. Next month, the U.S. Supreme Court will have the chance to deliberate what religious freedom does and doesn't mean for for-profit companies, when they take up a case from the craft store Hobby Lobby, whose owners want to deny their employees health care insurance that covers contraception. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Now to Bolivia, where weeks of heavy rain have swelled rivers, flooded homes, destroyed crops, and taken the lives of some 60 people in the country's lowlands. The state of Beni has been particularly hard hit, with the farming region losing over 70% of its cattle. To make matters worse, the lack of drinking water, mosquito-borne disease, and limited access to isolated communities all adds up to a dire situation. Our FSN Español correspondent Andrea Arenas spoke with Alfonso Simón, a resident in Beni, who has been affected by these severe weather conditions.
My entire family is living in this area. We are having about a 70% loss of the cattle herd in this area. And not only my family, the entire state of Beni in Bolivia is going to be affected in this same percentage, and it's going to be a catastrophic economic year for us and the entire country. We have about 50 people that have been killed lately and for these floods. We're very worried about the health of the entire people. The flood brings all kinds of contamination in its water, and we are having a health and economic emergency, a humanitarian emergency right now in Bolivia.
What kind of support and aid have people in this region gotten from the government or from organizations?
I can confirm to you that all the aid given by the government is not sufficient, and it's becoming a catastrophic situation, especially in the health of children and all these people, 80,000 people, that are living in streets and tents and have to drink and eat from this same water that's all contaminated.
Is there outside help coming into the Beni?
We've gotten a donation from the United Nations, and we've received the aid of the Argentinian and Peruvian government with two helicopters that are helping into evacuating persons. But from that, we haven't gotten any more aid, international aid or international help.
How do you think that this will affect the Beni, Bolivia, and the region in the long term?
Well, in the immediate long term, we all know that after a big flood comes very big epidemics. We have here in Bolivia yellow fever epidemics, and we have dengue epidemics that are already starting to show in the populations in Beni State. But we are still hoping to not have problems like cholera. The sewers have been overflooded, so all the water that already was contaminated with more than 250,000 dead animals is bringing all the sewer waters with it. So in health, we think it's going to be a catastrophe. Economically, if we lose 70% of the herd, of the cattle herd in this area, it's their main work in this state. So people is not going to have any work. And we hope the government or any international institution is going to be given loans or something to reconstruct the industry in this area. And as we see it right now and how things are, it's going to be a poor area becoming poorer. Maybe like the example of the earthquake in Haiti, where people that had little ended up with nothing and no direct help to how to reconstruct this economy.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Next up is Wisdom of the Elders.
KBOO is sponsoring an evening on the future of schooling in Portland at the Clinton Street Theater on Thursday, March 13th. It starts at 6 p.m. with a panel discussion that addresses what's ahead for public schools after the recent fierce contract battle, the case against high-stakes testing in privatizing schools, why public schools produce higher test score performances than private schools, and how we can work together to create truly wonderful schools. Speakers include Gwen Sullivan, president of the Portland Teachers Union, also school board member Steve Buell, and folks from the High School Student Union and Oregon Save Our Schools, a parent group. After discussion, we will present the film The Inconvenient Truth About Waiting for Superman. It's a film that debunks the attack on public education and teachers' unions. It all happens on Thursday, March 13th at the Clinton Street Theater at 6 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the March selection for the monthly Jefferson High School Multicultural Film Festival. This month, the film The Canary Effect will show on Tuesday, March 11th. The Canary Effect is a 2006 documentary that looks into the effects that the United States and its policies have on the indigenous population. That's The Canary Effect, Tuesday, March 11th at 6 p.m. at the North Killingsworth Library. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Circles. In our ancient traditions, nature is a circle, and all things strive for the harmony of roundness. In the old days, all power came from the sacred hoop of our nation. So long as the hoop was unbroken, the people flourished. Welcome to Wisdom of the Elders. I'm Arlie Neskai of the Dene Nation. In the next hour, we'll meet several members of the Monacan Nation. They are rebuilding their culture and remembering their history, which includes a prophetic meeting with Captain John Smith. We'll also hear from herbalist Judy Bluehorse Skelton. Nico Wynn acquaints us with the round dance, and we'll continue the musical journey with Paiute song carrier Judy Trejo.
Chubby little babies are round, and we age through roundness. The cycles of life is done with rhythm and a roundness to it.
And we'll hear the story of Grandma Sophie, about the Alaskan Diné way of life coming up on this chapter of Wisdom of the Elders. You're listening to Chester Knight and Wynn doing Sail on Silver Moon from the album Freedom on the Warrior label.